and welcome to the CAAV podcast. Today, we're talking about designated areas for landscape protection and nature recovery. The government has committed to protecting 30% of UK land for nature by 2030, and we're currently some way off that. There has been a raft of new announcements recently relating to increasing the number of protected areas, like national parks and SSSIs. So what does this all mean for landowners and farmers? Richard Sanders, Technical and Policy Advisor at the CAAV, joins me to find out more. So Richard, what's this all about?
Hi Olivia, good to speak to you again. So across England and Wales and Scotland, we've recently had some announcements relating to designated areas, as you mentioned, things like national parks and sites of special scientific interest, SSSIs. So I thought this was a good opportunity to take a look at some of the context for designated areas and also their management in the UK. This is another of those sort of less technical topics that's becoming a bit of my specialty, but there are some interesting and important things to think about in much of this that will have a knock-on effect for members and the advice that they're giving their clients in the future. It also gives us the opportunity to look across the question of land management and strategic thinking a bit more broadly.
So what were the announcements that grabbed your attention?
I'll start in Scotland and then I'll work my way around. So in Scotland, there's now a consultation open on the framework for assessing areas for a new national park. The background to this is a commitment to designate a new park by 2026. Interested groups and authorities are being encouraged to submit an expression of interest for designation. And from what I understand, there are several areas that are looking at this possibility, including it being reported that the Galloway National Park Association has registered an interest in this. In Wales, in its programme for government to 2026, the Welsh Government set out its intention to designate a new national park based on the existing Clwydian Range and Dee Valley AONB, the Area of Outstanding Natural Beauty. So far, in relation to this, the Welsh Government has instructed Natural Resource Wales to evaluate the case for designation. Later in 2023, there's going to be some stakeholder events, likely to include local landowners and farmers, as well as local authorities and the other interested parties as well. Then in September next year, so 24, there's going to be a process of public consultation with the potential designation at the end of 2025. In England, there have been several related announcements, stretching back over a couple of years, but with some recent stuff as well that sort of meant it was worth looking back a bit too. Listeners may remember the Glover Landscapes Review from 2019. Journalist Julian Glover was tasked with reviewing the current state of designated areas in England and their contribution to meeting the statutory purpose of the designated areas and also those wider government commitments that are set out in documents like the 25-year environment plan. And I think we're going to be coming back to this 25-year plan when we start to look into the broader question later. The Glover Review, amongst other things, recommended the creation of at least one AONB and also the case for the larger AONBs to potentially take on national park status. So since that review was delivered to government, there have been proposals for the extension of four existing AONBs and then the creation of two more, those two being in the Yorkshire Wolds and the Cheshire Sandstone Ridge. We've not had much further detail on the designation of these, so we're watching to see what comes out. A consultation has been run, and it closed this month, into the extension of the Surrey Hills AONB. For the designation of national parks, the Glover Review, so that's the review, so this isn't a government commitment necessarily, but the Glover Review looked at the Chilterns, potentially for designation, the Cotswolds, and also Dorset and East Devon. We haven't heard anything further from government on the proposed designation of these, so again, something to keep an eye out for. There's quite an interesting and varying history of designation in England, with a series of reports to government from around the 1940s onward, proposing areas that have either since been adopted, since become AONBs, and some haven't been designated at all. The Cornish coast, for example, was given quite a favourable view in the first report, the first of these reports to government, before being settled as an AONB. The South Downs, by contrast, which is England's youngest national park and was designated in 2010, was seen at that stage, so in those original reports from the 40s, as actually less suitable for designation. But now we see that being a national park when the Cornish coast has been an AONB. So lots of interesting history here, and we wait to see what follows on from the recent AONB announcements in England.
Let's look beyond the landscape designations for national parks and AONBs. Can you tell us a bit about the nature designations?
So I think that's right to draw a bit of a distinction between the two, and this is something important that we'll come back to as well. So elsewhere, we've got the proposed designation of what's been called a King's Series of National Nature Reserves, celebrating the coronation, with five proposed to be named over the next 5 years, including some extensions to existing ones from that point of view. More controversially, perhaps, or sort of attracting a bit more comment, is the notification of over 1,000 hectares of land in West Cornwall as a triple SI. The core of this area is an area of lowland heath, a bit of wetland and some semi-natural habitat, but that 1,000 hectares, or it's a bit more than that, but that area also includes surrounding agricultural land. That's because the condition of the groundwater is important for the condition of the site. And so Natural England have said that it's important to protect the wider area and the quality of the water that's feeding into those key areas and those core parts of the designated triple SI. Those wanting to undertake certain operations will need to apply for consent from Natural England and for West Penwith. So that's this proposed triple SI in Cornwall. This includes things like cultivations, alterations to the grazing regime, feeding out and using machinery on the land, and a list of other things as well.
So has this new designation been confirmed?
So the process for designation, in terms of the sort of the background principles of this, is as follows. There's an early assessment of the case for a triple SI, and then some engagement with local bodies before what's termed notification. So that is, if Natural England think that the scientific evidence is there to justify designation, and the relevant legislation for this, if those listening want to go and take a look, is the Wildlife and Countryside Act from 1981. So if they think it's worth designation, then they will notify the land in question as a triple SI. After that notification, there's then a public consultation on the proposals. And then where there are objections, which is quite likely to be the case for such a large area, as we're seeing in West Cornwall, the collected responses will be put to Natural England's board for a decision. So this is where we are now. And the board of Natural England is going to be considering the West Penwith designation on June the 28th. That's what's been published. And then to give its verdict by the 6th of July. Incidentally, Natural England were giving evidence in the House of Lords this week, ostensibly on the impact of regulations on development, on things like house building, commercial development, but actually the session had wider interest, looking at their legal responsibilities, powers, and working practices, as well as some of the context to these issues too. So it's an interesting listen for those who have the time. There's a lot of other detail in there, things like biodiversity net gain and nutrient neutrality. So a shameless plug here for the podcast that you and I did on the topic of biodiversity net gain, which can be got at wherever you found this podcast that you're listening to. I also did a webinar looking at biodiversity net gain in more detail, a recording of which will be available on the website. In their evidence in the House of Lords, Natural England set out in quite a bit of detail the process for designating new triple SIs. And for those interested just in this bit, those comments come in at about an hour into the session. So currently, we learn they're designating around 10 sites per year. In the 1980s, I gather this figure was in the hundreds, so recent activity is a bit slower from back then. Some of the more contentious sites are said to have been on the books, as they say, so being looked at for potential designation, for about 20 years, and the evidence is being gathered and those sorts of things. And Natural England is now looking at whether these should be taken forward to designation or not. So this reflects a bit of change in practice from their end, this slowdown in the number of designations. And those giving evidence for Natural England said that the barrier for proving that a site should be designated or not has actually risen significantly since the 1980s and that flurry of early designations.
So there's still quite a lot going on. Is there anything else that came up?
I think finally, I wanted to mention the ongoing questions, not about designation, but about the management of those sites that are already designated and ensuring that these are in good condition. Obviously, there's not much point in having a load of designated sites if many are in poor or declining condition. Listeners may have read the reports about management questions on Dartmoor, quite illustrative here, and the interaction there with the status of the triple SIs, and then the renewal of the agri-environment, the higher level stewardship schemes on certain areas of the moor as well. There's a target in the Environmental Improvement Plan, another of those key high level documents, and that one builds on the 25-year environment plan, to have 50% of SSSIs in England on track for favourable condition by 2028. So quite a high target here, and quite a bit of work to be done to ensure that not only is their land designated, but actually it's in good condition or working towards good condition.
So what's driving these designations? Why does there seem to be increasing focus on this issue?
I think the key driver for this, and the one that you hear about and read about in the recent reporting and the history and the discussion on the topic, is the Montreal Biodiversity COP agreement from last year, which sets out what's known as the 30 by 30 target. So that's the target that you mentioned at the top of the podcast, that 30% of our land and sea will be protected for nature by 2030. And the UK is a signatory to that COP agreement, so agreeing to that international law and therefore needing to reflect that in domestic policy and legislation. I think it's worth a little aside here to say that the COP agreement has other significant targets for domestic policy as well. So one target that's illustrative, target 7 in there, relates to reducing nutrient pollution. So we can think about the questions of nutrient neutrality in England and also agricultural pollution and the extension of the NVZ in Wales. As can be expected, the precedent for 30-30 is older than 2022. You know, it's not just simply it came up afresh last year. In the run-up to the climate COP in 2020, then PM Boris Johnson signed up to what was called the Leaders Pledge for Nature. And that pledge also includes this 30 by 30 target. So going back to that Natural England evidence session in the House of Lords, they were asked about the 30 by 30 target as well. And one of the Lords expressed what might be called the cynic's opinion, and I have a bit of sympathy for it, perhaps. And that's that this figure was a political promise, with all that looseness on feasibility and delivery that sometimes comes along with political promises.
So how does this filter down to UK policy?
So in this country, in the UK, we have a long history of setting our own quite challenging domestic targets and are often seen as something of a front runner then in those international agreements. For England, most recently, there's been the Environmental Improvement Plan. As I've mentioned, that builds on the 25-year Environment Plan, which was ahead of all these international agreements and the COP Montreal Agreement as well. That Environmental Improvement Plan contains a range of targets for habitat condition and species recovery. So in there is an ambition to create 140,000 hectares of wildlife-rich habitat by January 2028. In Scotland, there's a biodiversity strategy updated with the signing of the COP agreement, and that's also including the 30 by 30 ambition and also a goal to expand and improve the condition of protected areas. Both Wales and Northern Ireland also have biodiversity strategies, and those governments have both indicated their commitment to the 30 by 30 target as well.
So let's look a bit closer at this 30 by 30 target then. What are we talking about here? Is this going to be all SSSIs, or could national parks and other areas be included?
So Natural England are working with DEFRA, providing the scientific advice in setting out the detail of what is to count towards the 30 by 30 target. We're waiting to see the framework for that assessment, as it's going to be quite important and have knock-on effects then for land management questions and what happens in the future. The most we have so far, probably, in terms of government policy, is contained in the Nature Recovery Green Paper, which was put out in 2022. That Nature Recovery Green Paper also contains other quite interesting information as well on things like regulation and species management and those sorts of things. One thing we learned from the Green Paper is that national parks and AONBs are not seen to do enough for nature to count towards 30 by 30. And on reflection, that this seems to be about right. So these are, after all, more sort of landscape designations with the planning restrictions and so on that come along with that. So instead, not national parks and AONBs, but we need to be looking at areas that are managed for nature. So this is SSSIs, ASSIs, as they're called in Northern Ireland, and then also special protected areas, special conservation areas, and Ramsar sites as well. There's another designation here to bear in mind as well, and another acronym for use to get muddled in with all the others, and that's OECMs, standing for Other Effective Area-Based Conservation Measures. So these areas that are achieving the long-term and effective conservation of biodiversity, but are outside of designated protected areas, and what counts towards that is being looked at closely in the UK. So what might they be? You know, what sort of areas, what could we think about here? DEFRA's looking into it. And so all we can really do is ask questions at the moment. But maybe we're thinking about land in the higher levels, the more demanding bits of the new environmental schemes. So maybe Countryside Stewardship Plus in England, landscape recovery, or maybe things like Tier 3 land in Scotland, or in that 10% tree cover area in Wales. You know, we can only really speculate at this stage.
So how does the UK look so far for meeting these targets?
Yeah, so doing some quick sort of calculated napkin maths for the 30 by 30 target, we took figures from the JNCC, which is a statutory nature advisor in the UK. And so thinking about what I've said just now on what counts towards the targets, the figures, you know, and the, what I'm going to say in a minute doesn't include national parks or AOMBs. So that's important to bear in mind. So England's currently at 6.5% designated area in terms of counting towards 30 by 30. So in order to get to the target, we need around an additional 3 million hectares. In Northern Ireland, that's currently at 9.8%, needing around 300,000 more hectares. Scotland's 17.6%, reflecting the landscape in that region and perhaps a bit of government focus on designation there, but that's still going to need over 300,000 extra hectares. And in Wales, it's 10.6%, and that's around 400,000 additional hectares needed to meet the 30 by 30 target. So that's a lot of land, and also a lot of land where management practices might need to change significantly in order to count towards that target. You know, thinking about what I've said about national parks and AONBs, you need to be more for nature than those designations do already. So returning briefly to that Natural England evidence session that I've mentioned already and making good use of that context here, Tony Juniper, the chair of Natural England, did comment that the shortfall is not going to be made up through the designation of SSSIs or ASSIs. So we're thinking about the other measures there, those OECMs and what else can be done as well.
Gosh, there are some big figures there. How do you see this all coming together? It's a huge amount of land, a lot to plan and a lot of moving parts.
So yeah, that's right. A lot of moving parts and a lot of land and a lot of things that need to slot into place. So implementing all of this is going to require quite a strategic approach. And we're starting to see the development of these plans and frameworks. So for a long time, and everyone will be familiar with it, we've had land use planning in the form of local development plans and national planning frameworks, you know, the NPPF in England, PPW in Wales, and those sorts of documents as well. So these set out guidelines at the higher level, as well as doing the spatial bit of thinking about where new buildings should go, you know, local development maps in local areas and those sorts of things as well. But this has been heavily slanted to looking at development. You know, where can we dig up nature as opposed to where can we enhance it? So really, we're sort of planning for nature in the negative, perhaps, with these sorts of plans. Now, however, we're starting to see the development of positive planning for nature recovery that in many cases will work alongside and with these development plans. I'll make a quick distinction here between frameworks. So what I would think of as guidelines for how we plan for enhancing nature, and then plans. When I say that, what I'm talking about is the spatial identification land, so maps identifying areas. Just to draw this out, let's take a look at a quick example. And I'm going to look at two policies in England, but it's important to note that other jurisdictions as well are designing their own policies for this. Scotland has a land use strategy in place already, currently set to 2026. And in Wales, there are various related policies from national frameworks down to the mapping of peatland habitats and those sorts of things. So in England, at that higher framework level, we've been promised a land use framework to follow on from the food strategy, something that people may have read about and heard about already. Many non-government organisations have been feeding into this and the discussions around this. You know, some listeners may be familiar with the work of the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission. And if not, there's some interesting publications on their website about a land use framework and how we can bring all these things together. The Geospatial Commission, a government agency, have also been looking at how data and mapping information can be brought together for the better management of land. So this is a high-level strategy, setting out good working practices, areas of priority, digital alignment, and all those sorts of things. So then we can move down to the mapping level, still looking at England here, and think about the spatial strategies. The headline policy here is probably the requirement in the Environment Act for for local areas to prepare what's called a local nature recovery strategy.
So what do you think these strategies will look like?
The legislation here, for those who are interested in digging into the Act, is Section 106 of the Environment Act, and it requires a couple of things. The first is a statement of biodiversity priorities for the strategy area. So the country will be divided up into strategy areas, county levels perhaps, local authority areas. We wait to see exactly how this is decided. So that statement of biodiversity priorities is to provide a description of the strategy area and its biodiversity, a description of the opportunities for recovering or enhancing biodiversity in terms of habitats and species in the strategy area. So that's that positive element coming in here. The priorities in terms of habitats and species for recovering or enhancing biodiversity, a bit of strategic view here, and then proposals as to potential measures relating to those priorities. The second key part of the local nature recovery strategies in the legislation is a local habitat map for the whole strategy area. So now we're getting spatial. This, in turn, should show national conservation sites in the strategy area, any nature reserves in the strategy area, and then any other areas in the strategy area, which, in the opinion of the relevant local authority, so those preparing these strategies, are or could become of particular importance for biodiversity, or which areas where the recovery or enhancement of biodiversity could make a particular contribution to other environmental benefits. So we can sort of start to draw the parallels here with the existing planning system and its local plans and development maps. But here instead, we're talking about nature recovery and the positive restoration of habitats and the encouragement of species recovery.
Now, what does inclusion in these local nature recovery strategies and similar plans mean for land managers? Do they come with any obligations?
So what we've had so far is that DEFRA's published a guide for those authorities that are to prepare the strategies, setting out the approach that is to be taken when they do so. From a land manager's point of view, that guidance contains a few important points. We reviewed it, and if you search for local nature recovery strategies on the website, you can have a look at our note setting out a bit of the detail of that guidance. I think the first important point here is that while there is to be a process of consultation on the preparation of these strategies, and so engagement with landowners and land managers and tenants and farmers, there is no landowner or tenant veto to inclusion. So if it's decided that your land is to be identified in these local strategies, you can't unilaterally take it out from the strategy area. That said, having had an area of land identified within one of these local nature recovery strategies does not come with any particular hard obligations. So this isn't like a SSSI designation, for example. However, so while repeating that there's no particular requirements if you're included in this, we should start to think about how these strategies interact with other policies. And I'm just going to mention two other policies because, again, it helps to illustrate the point. The first is the future environmental land management schemes. So we know that part of the intention here is for some element of these, probably under Countryside Stewardship Plus or Landscape Recovery, so there's higher levels of the ELM schemes, those are going to be spatially targeted, at least in part. Now, the original intention, from what I understand, was for these local nature recovery strategies to interact quite closely with the local nature recovery scheme. And listeners will remember that this is the branch of ELMs, of the Environmental Land Management Schemes, that has now been replaced by the Enhanced Countryside Stewardship Scheme. So what might this mean going forwards? You know, maybe those in an identified area within the local nature recovery strategy will be able to access certain funding streams. You know, we're familiar with spatial targeting for CS currently. Things like water quality and air quality means that you can access certain options and have certain advice for your farm and putting together the plan for the agri-environment scheme from that point of view. So maybe this will be built on for the future ELMs. We wait to see. The second policy to look at here is biodiversity net gain, and we can have some examples and some illustrative points here too. A quick reference here back to my previous podcast and the webinar on the subject of biodiversity net gain. Under BNG, habitat on land identified in a local strategy, so not just local nature recovery strategies, but let's focus on those for the moment. So habitat on land identified in these strategies receives a boost of 15% to its value as habitat units. That That bit of word salad will become clearer after listening to the BNG podcast, so do take a listen if you're interested in biodiversity net gain. But in effect, what this means is that if you want to provide biodiversity offsetting, you get more units from the land identified in a local nature recovery strategy. You get more bang for your buck. Conversely to this, if you want to develop land, you have a harder bar to reach if your site is identified for nature restoration or protection in the local nature recovery strategies. You have to work harder to achieve your net gain because you're digging up habitat that has a higher starting value. So what we can see here is that being included in a strategy area has knock-on considerations for development opportunity and the like, but might also bring opportunities for providing biodiversity offsetting and those sorts of things. You know, you're more efficient within the market for biodiversity offsetting if you're within the strategy area. I think a small point here, if that all sounds a little bit spooky and a bit off-putting perhaps, is that land that's identified within a local nature recovery strategy for nature restoration, nature protection, is actually probably quite unlikely to have been in the sort of location where it would have been seen favourably for a development opportunity anyway. So there's a bit of self-selection in these processes anyway, particularly if there's joined up thinking between the nature strategies and the local development plans as well.
So what does this all mean for farmers and land managers? What are the on-the-ground implications here?
So I've said that there are not any hard obligations for being in these strategies, and it's important to remember that as the starting point. But what these strategies do is they start to shape the opportunities that are available and also to outline the barriers. So they shape the market. I've mentioned the boost you get for providing biodiversity net gain offsetting, you know, and I've mentioned the barrier to developing the land going forward. So zooming out a little bit and thinking a bit more broadly, we can think about William James's iron block universe here. So even if we have free will in all this, the choices we are faced with, the circumstances to hand, are such that there's only really one route that we can go down. Now that's a little bit gloomy, and hopefully not too many people are listening to this on their Monday morning commute. But the more serious way to take this is to say that every land manager is going to come to this on their own terms, looking at the strategies, looking at the opportunities, looking at their position and how that fits with the market, and then also their own goals, their own targets, their own view of things, and they're going to be making individual decisions. And I want to be clear here that there are opportunities that come with this. You know, new revenue streams, improved soil quality, enhanced natural capital, access to government opportunities, marketing, all those sorts of things, as well as the barriers that might jump out at us. It's for trusted advisors to help land managers achieve these goals that they have, you know, achieve the outcomes that they're looking for. And understanding some of the context of the changing rural sector is a key part of this.
So that then raises the question, how can members and their clients engage with all of this and make the most of it?
So I would agree that all of this can feel quite remote, you know, something decided on high, coming down to impact land use. But it does impact land use, so I think we need to have a look about it and think about how we can engage with the issue. The first thing to say here is that it's important to understand some of the background, some of the drivers. So this enables rural valuers, rural advisors, members of the CAAV, and also their clients to better seize the opportunities and also to plan ahead. You know, you can have a bit of foresight about what might be coming, what all of this means for the farm, for the estate, for land management decisions. It allows a heads-up approach, not just sort of reaction one way or the other to these policies when they're implemented. The second thing to consider is how to engage with these processes. You know, I've talked about the outline of local nature recovery strategies, and that's a good example. How do advisors or their clients in a particular area of the country engage constructively in the preparation of these local plans? Say we're interested in providing BNG offsetting, or we're thinking about tapping into government environmental schemes, thinking about those opportunities. How do you sort of promote land within a local nature recovery strategy? How do we identify the areas on the farm or the estate that would work well for this? You know, what are the opportunities here? Conversely, how can we understand the impact of these strategies on development opportunity and other plans for the future as well? What does this mean for our wider engagement with the local authority? And I think finishing up today, I just wanted to draw this point a little wider, zoom out a little bit on this issue. We all know that policy for rural areas has now come away from European decision making, you know, part of the process of coming back to DEFRA and within the competence of Westminster as well. And what this means is that across all of the devolved nations, that governments can now be more responsive and more reactive to comment and to feedback. So just recently, we've seen the increase in England of proposed payments for upland areas. You know, listeners may have been aware that for some elements of agri-environment schemes, there was a difference in payments for lowland areas and upland areas. This was sort of fed in to the process, raised as a bit of an issue. There was some commentary and some discussion. And now the balance has been put between those payments as well. They've been put on a level footing. We've also seen the change in structure of the ELM scheme I mentioned earlier. You know, DEFRA looked at the feedback to the proposed local nature recovery scheme, and actually it decided it was better to enhance countryside stewardship instead. So more flexibility, more reflective learning, and more ability to be responsive and reactive. So in light of this, how can all of us operating, giving advice and making decisions in the rural sector better engage with the developing policies and plans to achieve the outcomes that, even if not perfect, better reflect the wide variety of interests that are out there?
Thank you, Richard. You've raised some really pertinent points there and several questions for us to think about. Clearly, getting involved in the consultation process, whether at national or local level, is going to be key to influencing how this whole area develops. There's going to be an awful lot to keep up on over the coming months and years. So as ever, members can keep up to date through the detailed briefing notes on the CAAV website. Richard, thank you once again for joining me. And there we are. We've reached the end of yet another episode of the CAAV podcast. If you want to keep up to date with all future episodes, or indeed catch up on previous ones, please head to our website, or you can subscribe for free on whatever platform you use. Also, if you have any feedback or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch by emailing us on enquire@caav.org.uk. That's it for today, so until the next time, thank you very much for listening. Bye for now.